Good morning, or afternoon, wherever you might happen to be. And welcome to number two in the Multilingual TV Spring Series. Today, we're going to talk about race and linguistics and the language services industry. It promises to be a very lively conversation. You might hear a couple of things that make you uncomfortable, but that's good. The best growth happens from conversations that take us out of our comfort zone. One note, we will be conducting this mostly in English. There might be a little bit of Spanish thrown in, but that's the common language that we share. I think it's important, though, to sort of contextualize what we're doing. Far too often, we accept English as the default for everything, but it doesn't have to be. But we are intentionally doing this program in English. I have a great array of panelists here with me today, very knowledgeable people with wonderful perspectives on the issue that we're going to be talking about. And I'm going to kick it over to them so that they can introduce themselves. I think I will start. I'm just going to look at my screen here and see kind of go in no particular order. I'm going to start with you, Duane. If you could give us a brief 60-second introduction, please.
Okay. Well, good afternoon from this part of the world. My name is Duane Richardson. I am based in Canada, and I work as a freelance copy editor, translator from Portuguese, French, and Spanish into English, and I am an aspiring technical writer and editor. And just to give you a basic idea of some of the specialty fields I work with, that's generally the arts and media, a bit of history, architecture, and for the past at least 5 or 6 years, I have been working with a few clients who specialize particularly in diversity and inclusion, so the very topic that we are going to discuss today. So I look forward to this conversation, and I hope that I will be able to throw in a bit of my lived experiences and knowledge of whatever I can from a Canadian perspective. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you. Jenica.
So I'm Jenica Mares, coming to you from Paradise Island, Tobago, part of the Twin Island Republic of Trinidad and Tobago. I'm the CEO of Interpreting Your Needs, and my company helps individuals and companies alike to connect, to comprehend, and to collaborate. And we do this through multilingual communication services, including interpreting, translation, and public relations. I am a language acrobat, and I'm absolutely in love with the languages that I speak and the ones that I'm learning.
Thank you very much. Jamila.
Hello, everyone. It is great to be here with looking forward to sharing with everyone. My name is Jamila. I am the executive director of JAMI Linguist. I identify as a multilingual freedom fighter, social justice linguist, and entrepreneur. My professional background includes a certificate in simultaneous interpretation from Howard University, go Bison. And I also have an experience as an attorney, educator, and political organizer. In 2015, when JAMI Linguist was founded, our goal was to help people transform the one language fits all process to building movements for social justice. Most of our work revolves around helping build the individual and organizational capacity to leverage language to create change. And it's exciting. As a language coach, I also support language learners learning French, Spanish, Portuguese, and English. And I'm also a lifelong language learner that is in love with language because I'm in love with people. And I have a personal goal of learning a new language each year.
That's fantastic. Thank you. Errol.
Hi, my name is Errol De Jesus. I am based here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where it's gotten a little warmer. And I am a copywriter and a translator. My language pairs are English into Japanese and English into Spanish. And when I'm feeling lucky, vice versa, with a trusty editor. My real passion is writing and blogging, specifically about languages. And thanks to my son, I love blogging about being a mom and being a language learner and balancing that. And balancing multiculturalism and motherhood. And I do have a blog. It's called Underneath the Mommy. It's going through a rebranding right now. Don't look at it. But hopefully I'll figure out what I'm trying to do in the next 50 years and can offer some more advice on both writing and motherhood, hopefully. Happy to be here.
Nice. I'm going to have to check out your blog. We're raising our son multiculturally, so it's probably got some great tips. Autumn.
Awesome. So yes, my name's Autumn Smith. I am a soon-to-be graduate of Middlebury Institute of International Studies Translation and Localization Management Program. Should graduate on Saturday. I am very excited to be moving forward. I'll be working as a localization program manager at Facebook starting in June. In terms of who I am, I'm a linguist at heart. I've always loved languages. I've studied Japanese since I was about 8 years old and always knew that that was what I wanted to do. My passion is around building community, specifically building communities around localization and providing opportunities for the future generations of localizers to have space to speak. And so part of that is being the social media manager for the first student chapter of Women in Localization at MIS. I also am the TLM student ambassador for the program, and I helped co-found an organization called Camp Loc, which provides interactive learning experiences for students of localization in person at companies. I also have recently gotten involved with Global Sake, which is an amazing organization that is all about taking products global and bringing localization to the greater conversation more upstream with clients and making it so that we really have a voice in those spaces. So I'm really excited to be here and can't wait to talk to you all.
Thank you so much. And Kamisia.
Hi, everyone. So my name is Kamisia Glasgow. I'm joining you all from Atlanta, Georgia, though originally I'm from Trinidad and Tobago, so the same island that Jenica is joining us from, Tobago. And I've always had a, you know, lifelong love affair with languages, just like everyone else. I'm a former community interpreter, having worked primarily in the immigration legal space, as well as the special education space. And so I came into interpreting through a multilingual justice practice, and I am currently sort of in my own rebranding. I guess that's a popular theme here, but in identifying making my name in localization as a field in particular at the intersection of language and technology. You know, through life, I've done a lot, including in teaching Spanish and working in nonprofits and civil rights organizations and co-founding, back when I was in college forever ago, this organization called the Student Language Exchange that offered an opportunity for multilingual, multicultural, international students to become teachers of their native languages, which were often ones that weren't taught in school in the university. So Swahili, Albanian, Tagalog, etc. And that was pretty cool. It spread to a few campuses thanks to our co-founder. But anyways, I am in a recent role as well with Multilingual as the partner events consultant, bringing you more events like these forthcoming. So I'll pass the word back to you, Michael.
Thank you very much. And last, and actually probably least important, I'll introduce myself. My name is Michael Reed. I'm the managing editor of Multilingual. I started in this industry as a translator and interpreter. My working languages are Japanese, Spanish, French, Portuguese, and Greek. I had a stint in higher ed, but it was quite extended as a language professor as well. So that's what brings me into this space. Thank you, everybody, so much for being here. I'm really excited for this because I think we can all agree this is a conversation that needs to happen and is kind of conspicuous by its absence in this industry and in this space. So I'm really glad that we're all here together to share our different perspectives. So the first thing I want to ask, and you know, let's have this be about a 2-3 minute thing, and then we'll sort of get more into the weeds of it. But in a high-level way, what have you observed about the state of diversity and inclusion in the language services industry? And just, you know, for background, I did an article, for example, in Multilingual Magazine back in November, December called Linguistic Blackout. I'm not trying to plug it. I'm just trying to say It came about because when I was growing up as a young Black nerdy kid in a multilingual neighborhood who loved languages as well, I didn't see anybody that looked like me represented in the translation industry or as a linguist or anything like that. And even to this day, you don't really see that much. That's why I wrote the article. And it turns out Black people in general are pretty underrepresented, and especially African Americans in the United States in the language services industry. So that's sort of the perspective that I'm coming from. And I think it looks different in different parts of the world, but I just want to hear from each of you, like I say, in about, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, what has your experience of linguistics and the language services industry been as relates to diversity and inclusion? And we're going to go the opposite direction this time. So Kamisi, I'm going to start with you.
Oh my, I was not expecting that.
My bad. We can go to Autumn, but I think Autumn's going to feel some kind of way about that. So.
No problem. So that's an excellent point you make. I think that where I noticed the gap, as it were, was primarily in the bridge from education to career. So I think that really to discuss, you know, there is an absence or we are a minority, right, in the field, but then we try to think about why that is. And for me, there simply were not valid paths presented that showed how I could get from where I was graduating and what I was interested in to those interests and to being an actual practitioner, sort of short of the interpreting, which I did enjoy, but was not actually where I wanted to land. Where I wanted to land was in media translation, you know, working for Netflix or something like that. And, in my case, despite taking translation courses in school, my professors were very disconnected from like the actual industry. And so I think that there's a way in which we need to consider localization and translation and language services as industries, and consider the genesis of those industries really having a lot to do with tech. And kind of when we consider the question of inclusion with that in mind, I think that maybe some answers begin to illuminate more clearly. Anyways, I'm not sure that answer.
No, it does. It
does. Question, but that's what came to mind.
It does. And I think, you know, we're starting to circle around something that I know we're going to come back to because it's germane, which is the sort of language services industry, tech industry interface. And I think, you know, we've talked about before, in some ways, the language services industry tries to behave as a tech industry with a language component, but it's the opposite. The reality is that it's the opposite. Mm-hmm. But when we look at some of the problems endemic to the tech industry, and we see them replicated in the language services industry, we see how many points of contact there actually are there. And I think we're also starting to touch on something. I'm not trying to take this over. I'm going to kick it over to you, Autumn. You're going to be next. Just get ready. But I think there's a class element at play here as well, because something you said about, you know, growing up and looking at career paths put me in mind of how I felt. When I was looking at career paths, I wanted something that I could live my passion, but I also knew it had to be something that I could make a living doing. You know, a lot of us came from a background where we didn't have the option of doing something that wasn't going to be pretty well paying. We didn't have a lot to fall back on. We wanted to live our passion, but it had to be something that paid the bills because we grew up in an environment where that was really important. So I think there's an element of that at play here. I can see some of those threads weaving through. So I'm going to be quiet now. Autumn, it's your turn. I promise. Yes. I'll shut up.
No, I think just piggybacking off of a few of the concepts that have been brought up, definitely from my personal experience, you know, growing up, I was also the Black nerd kid who was super into language. And that was such a weird thing to do, because what are you going to do with language? What are you going to make of that?
Are you going to pay the rent with that?
You're not. And you don't have mommy and daddy sitting in the corner going to give you money if you mess up and you want to be an artist, like some exotic artist. It just doesn't work like that, which is a whole element we can talk about later. But going back to the main crux of the conversation, and you kind of mentioned a lot of these themes in your article, but in terms of the language services industry, the idea of diversity is different, right? The idea of diversity, it's like, yes, we have people from all over the world. We're very diverse. But when I look around the room, I'm the only person on the team that looks like me. This is acknowledged. Like I was working as an intern last summer, and I was the only person of color on the team during the George Floyd incident. And I really felt that. And luckily there was a group I could turn to be like, hey, I don't have anyone to talk to about this. But as you mentioned, like, for example, Google, in your article, you mentioned has 3.7% Black employees as of May of last year. And as of the summer, the numbers at Facebook were even lower. I think it was not even 1%. And so there's that tech intersection of the localization industry, but there's also just the idea of what is diversity and what does that look like? And when we're having these conversations on teams, like acknowledging that diversity doesn't just mean having people from lots of different countries. It also means different cultural backgrounds. It also means people who have a different lived experience. Because I think that as someone who's mixed, there's the cultural mix within me that acknowledges that lived experiences are different, even amongst Black people, which is something that I often acknowledge when I'm asked to speak for all Black people, because I'm the only one there. And I'm like, I cannot.
Yeah. Oh, I cannot. Been there. I think we've all been there. It's like, oh, okay, I guess I'm the ambassador of Blackness now. All right. Yeah.
I've been called out on that because I'm often, as the mixed kid, you would know, I'm often told, like, you know, your experience is much different. And I'm like, I cannot speak for the whole of Black people in the world. I'm sorry. So anyway, I'm getting tangential, but main themes, the intersection of tech and understanding that those percents are very low. And when we talk about diversity, what are we actually talking about?
Absolutely. Errol.
Okay, I tried to take notes. I just want to start off by saying I keep this unicorn balloon in my living room and I look at it every day and I go through my daily affirmations because I had to remind myself that I am a unicorn and I'm very unique. And as Black people, we're just going to stand out, especially in industries where we are underrepresented, which is unfortunately a lot of industries. and so initially I really thought that the issue was visibility. When I think about, okay, I don't see a lot of Black people in language services, or maybe I'm not digging hard enough. Maybe I have to go beyond the first page of Google, which any SEO person will tell you that's like the best place to hide a dead body because nobody goes off of page one of Google. So I thought, okay, then what is it? How do we get higher on Google? And I fell in love with marketing and advertising. And then the more I learned about it, the more I just saw less of me. And it really is an uphill, you know, struggle. But at the same time, there's a lot of need to embrace the creativity and the solidarity with it. And also acknowledging that it's just, we've got a long way to go. But as long as you know that you're special and not trying to do it in like a Teletubbies Barney kind of ABC kind of way. But it is very important to remember that. Yeah, I mean, just being in some of the rooms with executives that are giving out ideas, I'm like, what? I could have thought of that. What the? It's just like, you have to have that confidence and that understanding that, you know, we need you. We need more of you. We need you here. Otherwise, you're not going to be there and you're not going to be the one that kid's going to see and be like, oh, my gosh, I want to be like that someday. Or like, oh, my gosh, you have my dream job. And it's just, it's a lot. It's a lot. And, you know, it's hard being a unicorn. They're really cool. And it's a lot to hold up. But that's what I've learned so far. So,
and, you know, that hits on an interesting point, too, because there are a lot of times where you can't wait for somebody to open the door for you. You have to go and kind of pound on the door and say, or to offer you a seat at the table, to throw every metaphor I can in here, you have to go up to the table, pull the chair out and say, I deserve to sit here. I know just as much or more than any of you here. I deserve a seat. Whether you choose to give it to me or not, that's another issue. But I deserve it. And I'm going to let you know that I deserve it. I'm going to let you know that I know I deserve it, and that you probably on some level know that you deserve it. But then we start sliding into a lot of the issues that come up when we talk about diversity and inclusion, right? Because everybody wants to say, oh, what can be done? Oh, what shall we do? Oh, what? Well, sometimes what you can do is give up some of your own power, give up some of your own privilege. So, and sometimes what people are saying is, what can we do that doesn't in any way threaten our own position and our own privilege? Well, I'm sorry, we might as well not have a conversation if that's the condition you're going to put on it, because maybe you will have to give up some of your privilege. Sometimes allowing another person to claim their rightful space means getting out of some of the space that you've usurped. And if you're not willing to do that, I'm sorry, why are we even having a conversation about it? Okay, I promised I would shut up. I'm very bad at keeping that particular promise, apparently. Jamila, it is on to you.
Well, to the question, I think we often use the phrase language services. And when you're thinking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, I think the question is, who are we serving and why? And because if you're looking at an absence, then you have to look at the root causes of, okay, who are we serving? Are we serving large conglomerates and huge companies that are trying to market products and figuring out how to tap into a digital market? Because that group of people has a very distinct set of needs. Are we targeting, hospitals or legal services organizations or those kinds of things and the people that they serve? What I think often happens when we talk about language services, we're talking about private sector and largely corporate academia, right? In the area where people of color, Black, Brown, Indigenous folks, LGBTQ folks, marginalized, underrepresented groups are most served in multilingual capacities are areas where the law mandates it. So the law says, if you come to court, you are entitled to an interpreter if you don't speak this language and you are charged with a crime. If you go to the hospital and the doctor says, we need to discuss your treatment, you are entitled to an interpreter. But if you walk into a business and you're a bilingual employee and you speak these two languages, you're not necessarily entitled to get your HR documents in Amharic, right? Mm-hmm. When you go to those spaces, unless that company has deemed you important enough for their bottom line to adjust how they manage their business to incorporate multiple languages into their business. So I think when we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, the world is overwhelmingly non-white. The people who speak multiple languages are overwhelmingly non-white. And those are the people who are being hired as translators, who are being hired as interpreters, but they're not necessarily the people who are getting the highest profit share of the large tech firms who are setting the decisions for what AI projects will be launched and when, what languages will focus on, and those kinds of things. So the decision makers in the industry are largely monolingual white men that have a specific set of goals for why they want to reach multilingual communities of color. And it's largely a very one-directional form of communication. We want to get you this information so that you'll buy this. We want to get you this information so that you'll click this. And we want to get, we want your feedback and your input so that we can, train our AI robots and those kinds of things. But it's not really about bringing decision makers into the fold about who we service and why. And for that reason, we don't see a lot of people of color at the helm, and Black people in particular at the helm, because of, the same things that give us less access in other industries are the same thing that are relevant in this industry. In this industry, as Michael said, intersections between class and so forth. But it's really about who we're serving and why.
And, you touch on something really important. Monolingual Anglophones have kind of carved out a space for themselves in the upper echelons of language services, which is very ironic.
Monolingual Black folks.
No.
Because we can't talk about AAVE and why, we can't talk about why the English that I speak, the vernacular that I speak is something that also needs to be integrated.
Absolutely.
I think that's valuable.
No, that is very, very true. Well, and we even see in the sort of deracinated form of English that tries to pass itself off as a lingua franca globally, which I have issues with, that's still only about 20% of the human population that has any ability to speak English whatsoever. We're including native speakers, second language learners, whatever. So that's 80% of the world that doesn't speak English at all. But this sort of imagined universality of English, that deracinated version of English that's pushed out, has nothing to do with the English that you and I grew up speaking, which is just as legitimately English. And in fact, I use this word very carefully, but there is a way in which it can be considered a sort of almost indigenous form of English, because it's the form of English that we created because we were brought here intentionally in mixed language groups, so we couldn't communicate with each other. So we had to build something up from the ground. So no, I think that's a really good point. And that who are we serving is a really key question as well. All right, so now, and this is why I'm particularly happy. I mean, I'm happy to have all of you here, but I'm really happy to have Dwayne and Jenica here, because I want to get the non-USian perspective of this. Because I think what we forget is the Black experience, A, even within one country, does not look the same. Trust me, right now I'm in Washington State, which is a very different experience than when I was growing up in California. So those are just two totally different things. But the Black experience in France is going to be different than the Black experience in the US, which will be different than the one in Canada, which will be different than the one in Greece, et cetera, et cetera. So I like bringing this more multinational perspective to it. So Jenica, same question to you.
So let me just say that listening to my colleagues from the global North, and me being in the global South, I feel actually very privileged, because I grew up in diversity. My family is diverse. My country is diverse. Today, by the way, it's a national holiday. It's Eid al-Fitr. It's a national in a majority Christian country. And that's the diversity that I grew up with in high school, where it was a Presbyterian high school, all girls, no guys around to distract us. But we celebrated every festivity you could think of, every different religious denomination, national holidays. And we did so as a normal thing. So I guess I am, in a sense, colorblind to the fact that I've been in this diverse environment. When I hear you, Camicia, speak about perhaps that gap between education and opportunities, I have to say, like, I had a golden bridge, because I was able to go from high school straight into the world of work. I didn't go directly into university because I hadn't figured out yet what I wanted to do. And I'm from a family where, listen, you gotta pay the bills. You're 18 now, so I got a job. And thankfully, that job was in the area of languages, English language, but media. And that's where I was able to confirm my love for languages and make that very smooth transition from work to education, to say, okay, I'm gonna pursue a Bachelor of Arts in French, because I realized in the 2 years of post-high school work that I was meeting so many people as a journalist, including business missions who were coming from across the Caribbean to Trinidad and Tobago. And I realized, look, foreign languages is it for me. Venezuela is like 750 kilometers away from Trinidad. The whole of South America is at my doorstep. We've got in the Caribbean, you've skipped from one island to the next. You go from English speaking to French speaking to Dutch speaking to Papiamento, to Spanish, of course, Cuba, Dominican Republic. So literally in my backyard, diversity is there. So I was able to very quickly see that I live in a land of opportunity. And so going to university, being able to get my undergrad degree, French and Spanish, that again, opened up another golden bridge for me through exchange programs, where I was able to travel and do study abroad. The option was there to go to metropolitan France, but I'm a Caribbean girl. I don't do cold. So I went to Martinique, right? I got the French experience on an island, not too far from home. Okay. And again, that opened up so many other possibilities and opportunities for me, because I was getting to meet people in certain circles who were, you know, influencers, movers and shakers on the Caribbean scale, And I was able to see very quickly, wow, I can fit in there. I can make space for myself in there. And so I'm taking you a bit through my academic journey as well. I was able to then move on from a bachelor's to master's in communication. But another opportunity, I did that master's at a French university while living in Guadeloupe, and I did it online. And this was back in 2004. So I was able to move away from my Anglophone background, study communications in the French language in French West Indian island of Guadeloupe. And again, more opportunities opened up to me. I was able to then go on to study interpreting back at home at the University of the West Indies, St. Augustine campus. So I didn't have to go outside of the region. I didn't have to be part of that whole brain drain culture seeking after opportunities in the north. I found all of the opportunities that I never even dreamed of, actually. I found them right here in the global south, right at home, right across, you know, across the ocean, across the Caribbean Sea, in Martinique, Guadeloupe, in Haiti, Dominican Republic. These are all countries where I've studied. And so I am really privileged today, having taken some of the tangential turns in life, gone, you know, worked globally. But I came back last year during the pandemic, came back home, set up my company, Interpreting Your Needs. And I'm just really proud and privileged to say that I am back in my region to serve my region, to your insightful remarks, Jamila. Who are we serving? Well, I'm very clear in my mind that I'm serving the people of my region, and I am serving them through multilingual services so that they can grasp the opportunities that they just maybe had not known of, but that I was privy to from a very early stage. So I'm just one of the privileged few Black people around here.
You know, I really like that you bring that into it, because you touch on something that I, you know, this is one of my blind spots, because I hadn't really thought of it and I hadn't contextualized it in that way. But something you said really, really drove something home for me. I like how you've very consciously pursued opportunity and maximized your opportunity in the global South, because so many people in the global South are given the message implicitly or sometimes explicitly that opportunity will be found in the global North, right? Outside of where you are. I mean, even look at like wildly successful musical acts. If, you know, like from Maluma from Colombia or Anita from Brazil, people like that, right? Who are like really, really successful and do great music, IMO, in their at home, but then they make it big, and you know, they make it big at home, and then they're sort of told, oh, to really make it big, you need to make it big in the United States, right? Which means, you know, you're probably going to need to sing in a little bit more English. Even if you're not comfortable with it, you know, better do it. Or, you know, so I really like this idea of saying, no, opportunity doesn't have to be over there. It can be here at home. So I really appreciate that.
And just dovetail quickly on that. Like all of you, I didn't have the option to go looking further than my backyard. My parents didn't have the means. And so I really decided to switch my mindset and say, you know what? I don't have the option to go up north like most of my high school sisters who sat the SAT exams. They all got full scholarships and they shipped off north. Well, I was left behind because one, I didn't do well in the SATs. And two, I thought, I haven't figured out what I want to study yet. I did not figure out what I wanted to study. So why am I going to university and I don't know what I want to study? So I'm working. And of course, because I have to get some money. So it's, I didn't have those options. And therefore, I decided, since I don't have those options, this is my option. I'm going to make the best of this current option.
Good for you. No, that's excellent. And that resonates with me. I did part of my college career over in Japan. And part of it was because it was what I could afford. It was the program that I could afford. That actually wasn't my first choice. I already spoke Japanese. I've spoken it since I was young. I wanted to do something. I actually wanted to go to Germany because I didn't speak German. But I couldn't afford the program at all. So Japan was the one I could afford. But much like, you know, I was like, I'm gonna make the best I can out of this. It was a wonderful opportunity. I'm so happy I kind of fell backward into it. And yeah, it was one of those things that a choice that was made based on restricted opportunity actually opened up a whole bunch of doors for me. And thank you, by the way, for reminding us that it's Eid al-Fitr. So Eid Mubarak al-Jama'ah to everybody who celebrates the end of, for those of you who don't know, it's the end of Ramadan. So that's, it's a big deal. This is a big day for a lot of people. All right. And Dwayne.
All right. Well, I've had quite the opportunity to try to soak in everything that has been said so far. I did say from the very beginning that I am based in Canada. However, what I did not say is that I hail from a family that immigrated to Canada in the 1980s. And if you are curious to know, my parents were born in Georgetown, Guyana, so in South America. So like Jenica, you know, Guyana is one of those countries that borders along other countries such as Venezuela to the west. You have Suriname and French Guiana to the east, and to the south, you have Brazil. So it is true that, you know, even though my family, my parents didn't speak any other language, I was actually, I was geared toward learning languages when I grew up in the primary school system in Canada. And I should also say that I'm from Toronto, Ontario. So I've been in mm-hmm. Quebec now for just almost 15 years. And, you know, like Autumn, I was, you know, a nerd at heart. I was a language nerd, and that's what propelled me to, you know, jump into the language industry. But to get there, you know, I had to take a few other, you know, loops around music and, you know, modern languages and literature and such. I'm mentioning all of this to say that, you know, having come from a Caribbean background, inclusion for me wasn't really much of a problem, because growing up in Toronto, you see, I had the privilege of being around groups that, you know, that were around people, I should say, in groups that were like me, basically. And I think now moving forward to my training, my translation training at one university here in the Montreal area, known as McGill University, I was lucky to be around people from the, well, hailing from, I should say, the BIPOC and the LGBTQ plus community. So in terms of studies, I didn't feel like I was excluded in any way, shape, or form. And I say this especially because I was registered in the Spanish to English option. So already I was around students hailing from mostly Hispanic communities, but also from my community. And here in Quebec, you know, there were some French Canadian and English Canadian speaking communities as well. So school-wise, diversity was not a problem. However, as I jumped into the career spheres here, well, that's where, okay, there is a bit of a problem with respect to representation. I've had very few opportunities to work in-house, but when I have worked in-house, I have noticed, in and outside of the translation and interpretation industry, that there were very few people like me. Very few people, that is to say, from the BIPOC community. Although, you know, when it came to LGBTQ plus and such, yes, you know, that community was present. But there were few people like me. And when it came to happy hours, as they call them here, you know, those types of activities that you do after work, basically, I've noticed that when I've gone to these happy hour activities organized by translation and interpretation professionals, that, again, there were very few people like me. And this was apparent at an activity that I attended back in September 2019. So this was before the pandemic hit. And, you know, I would remember just walking into the room, and it was a large room, a lot of noise and everything, but there were very few people like me. I remember meeting one person, I believe, from the East Asian community. But I think we were one of the two, I think, people who were among all of, you know, the translators, the interpreters and such. So I think that I think here in Canada, what I'm saying is that I've noticed the lack of diversity, and I hate to step on Quebec toes here, but here in Quebec, where I've lived for nearly 15 years, I think that the lack of diversity is even more apparent than it is, say, in Ontario. That is to say, in English Canada, generally, I find that when it comes to when it comes to diversity, English Canada is being a better steward than Quebec, because here in Quebec, it's still a predominantly white, you know, Catholic, French Canadian population. Now, that is to say, there are some strides made, but I think they are very timid, and it's going to take a bit of time before I think Quebec can take its stance insofar as diversity. So there it is. I think that that's what I can say. You know, I had a lot of lofty goals when I was younger, and I thought that, you know, I would be a bus driver, and that's why you see a bus roll sign behind me, a trolley bus roll sign. I had the lofty goal of being a professional singer and that sort of thing. And again, in the arts and media industry, we're there too, you know, lack of diversity. But, you know, realistically, you know, how was I going to pay the bills and such? And so I eventually went back to school and pursued a degree in modern languages and communication that led to translation. Here I am. But again, I'm repeating myself, but I think that diversity in the TNI industry, insofar as Canada, I think there is still some work to be done, and particularly here in Quebec.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate that perspective. And a lot of my family is Canadian. In fact, one of my cousins lives just outside of Ottawa. So I see exactly what you're talking about. We take trips to Montreal sometimes, and so I dig where you're coming from. Jamila, I know you have to dip in about 10 minutes. So, and you want to, and then Camisio, you wanted to say something too. So Jamila, I'll let you get to your comment, and then Camisio to yours.
Thank you. Yes. So I was like having all the feels when Jenica was talking. I had just finished talking. Not my turn yet. But I want to just say, because I do have to answer a question that hasn't been asked before, I have to leave out. I feel very similar to how Jenica feels, right? I got my simultaneous interpreting certificate from Howard University, right? And so I was surrounded, my professor spoke 9 languages. It was from Martinique, Black woman who was extraordinary. And with a Black Cuban professor and an African-American professor, folks who were international, like the experience that I had of Blackness was an international Blackness. And in the work that I do, I have very purposely surrounded myself by my people, right? So whether it is, you know, women, people of color, Black folks, LGBTQ folks, I very purposely, so I don't necessarily on a day-to-day basis feel like I'm not included, because I have carved out the space. And I want to just say, for folks who are interested in getting into the field, when you're looking for opportunities, other interpreters and linguists are your network, right? When I'm in this panel, I already know I'm hitting up everyone on the panel, because I probably have a job or opportunity for you in the near future. You know what I mean? So I look for my people. I look to pay my people. I look to work with my people. And then my people look for me. And so I don't necessarily feel like I'm waiting for someone to give me an opportunity. Language services is not... Tech is dominated by small groups of people, but the language service providers, there are not huge conglomerates that have overwhelmingly taken over the market. It is a unique industry in that sphere that a lot of small service providers can carve out multi-million dollar spaces just by doing quality work and connecting with people and being real with people. So I just wanted to say, like, my experience in language has been very Black, has been very female, has been very gay. And I've loved it for that reason, because it's been purposeful. And for folks who are in the U.S., similar to, you know, the capacity to travel, different people have that. I know that there are a lot of folks who are in the U.S. who feel like, I want to learn this language, but I can't travel to Japan. I can't travel here. You can't travel to Haiti, but you can go to Florida and learn Creole, because there's tons of Haitians in Florida. You can't travel to the Middle East, but you can go to Michigan and learn Arabic over there, because there's a huge community of Arabic speakers. You want to go to Ethiopia, but you don't feel like you can afford it? Come to DC. There are Eritreans. Mm-hmm. Ethiopians that speak Amharic that are ready to talk to you, right? So you can go to your backyard anywhere in the world, in this country, and find someone who speaks another language to connect with and build your skills. And so I just wanted to encourage that thought process of using the resources that are here, networking amongst ourselves and not looking, because we really are the people who have the skills, so we can control the industry if we work together.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. And my experience speaks to that as well. I didn't learn Japanese in Japan. I learned it in San Francisco because I lived in Japan. I was raised in Japantown, right? I didn't learn Spanish in a Spanish-speaking country. I learned it in California because that was the other neighborhood language. Like, you know, and my mom was a French speaker. So I, you know, before I ever went to France, I spoke French. So you're right. You don't, your economic situation may restrict some of your opportunities. Yes, but depending on where you live, you don't have to necessarily go that far. You're 100% right, Jamila. You don't have to necessarily go that far to be able to have some of that immersive experience. Absolutely. All right, Kamisia, you wanted to say something too.
Yes, I did. And oh my goodness, I am so glad at the direction that this conversation has taken, just all of the many curves. I feel like I could respond to each, intervention individually, and I won't because we don't have time for that. But a couple of things that I wanted to say, or maybe I'll just start with the main takeaway, and hopefully these subpoints will come up as I explain. So when I mentioned the gap kind of between education and opportunity, as I worded it, I was thinking more in terms of career directly, right? But then as I heard Jenica speak more on this, what do I want to say? I feel like a unicorn. I feel like a unicorn because I went to an Ivy League school. I had a lot of opportunity. I received a lot of financial aid. I was able to study abroad because of it. And because of fellowships and things like that. And yet there was still a gap, right? And on the one hand, I would say sort of there's a gap that is external facing, and that might be the discussion that maybe more interests the people who tuned into this webinar. But on the other hand, there is a deeper gap that I want to just give to right now, which was the rupture, really the uprooting that I felt, that I experienced, frankly, when I migrated to this country as a child from Diego, and that I felt was necessary to be successful, right? So I hearing Jenica is like hearing what I would have wanted for my life or something like that, right? Or something that always seemed kind of more a fantasy than an accessible reality. And it's curious to say, right? Because I'm a creative person, I'm a poet, clearly I'm, you know, intelligent. I'm not tooting my own horn here. I hope it doesn't sound like that, but I'm saying, like, why would I have, why would it not occur to me to pursue a path as hers? And I'll tell you why. It's because, from the jump, right? When I first came to this country, I lived in the panhandle of Texas, very white area, right? And then I went through most of my schooling in Atlanta. Most people think of as a very black area. I happen to live in a very white town within that and go to what's commonly called the best public school in the area. And in that school, in that high school, I was in this interesting conundrum, or not conundrum, but I was just in this interesting place of, okay, this black city, but all of my neighbors and all of my classmates, for the most part, are white. And it was weird because even within the school, we had a demographic split of about, I would say, 48% white, 48% black, and then, you know, mixed other with the remaining percentages, and except my classes were not like that, right? In my AP classes, I was often one of maybe two black students, right? And going into college, like I kind of differently kind of, you know, because I was a nerd, right? I wanted to be a linguistic anthropologist. Like I almost went to Not Brown because I wanted to study with a specific professor at Swarthmore College. But anyways, my point is though, that all of these decisions that I made, and then again, when I got to this PWI, predominantly white institution for college, I had the irony of feeling like, oh my gosh, my classes are so diverse. Look at this. I get to have friends who are my complexion and they're smart and they're alternative and they're into, you know, punk music and all of these things. Like that for me was an entry point into diversity. Whereas for a lot of my friends who were coming from like South Central LA and these places that were more ethnically homogenous or coming from abroad, right? And you know, like countries like Jamaica or whatever that are also pretty ethnically homogenous, like it was very shockingly white. And for me, it was very diverse. And I think, I guess what I'm just trying to point at is this tension, right, that kind of in my own life, and I can only speak to it in, with any degree of expertise, but has always existed between being who I am and being where I'm from and doing what needs to be done and coming into success, you know? And anyway, sorry, I don't want to monopolize, but one last thing also, I just thought it was so funny, again, as Jenica was talking about her studies, because I have been looking into master's programs. And recently, in the month of March, you celebrate the month of the Francophonie. So Francophone culture and studies, it's a whole month. And it's pretty nice because it's one of the rare times where at large, you're talking about the French language and you're not just talking about France. But I went to an event here that the Francophonie Atlanta had sponsored, or I went to an event, I went on Zoom because that's what we're doing these days. And anyways, I was very, very excited because it was about pursuing graduate studies abroad. And this is a topic I do know a bit about, but you know, always open to learn more information, especially because I have been trying to figure out how I can study in Martinique specifically. And it just said it's pursuing graduate studies in the Francophonie. And so I was excited. Imagine my surprise when I get there and the panel is only representing France, Quebec, and Switzerland. And when I asked questions about, okay, how might I study in the Antilles, you know, it was as though it had never dawned on them, right? Mm-hmm. That somebody would want to do that. And I did have the opportunity to study, well, not study, in France a couple of years after graduating. And that was another situation, kind of as Duane was mentioning, where, you know, it's in, I, there were three of us, right? There were three Black people in my whole regional group. We saw each other immediately when we got there. But
you're lucky there were three of you. I was the only one in my France study abroad.
Right. I was the only Black person when I went to Argentina, right? So I'm glad you said that, because I had had the opportunity to study and research extensively in Argentina through undergrad. And so by the time I got to France, I already knew, like, okay, I'm going to want some sort of co-racial community. And I knew that it would exist, right? France obviously has a multiracial demographic, given its colonial history primarily. But where I was located was in the south of France, and that's a bit of a different milieu. So anyways, all of that is to say, I started this group called for the assistance of the language assistance of color. And it was interesting to say the least. Sorry, I believe I skirted the point that I was going to make, but I am okay. Going to recognize that I've been talking for quite a while. But, oh, and as you were speaking, Michael, actually, about the even musicians, right? Mm-hmm. So immediately comes to mind Rihanna, right? I love Rihanna, right? And I remember, shout out to my mom, who some years after, I guess somewhere between Umbrella and Fenty, right? But like towards Fenty, maybe after Man Down. I don't know how familiar our audience is with her repertoire, but I'm a big fan.
They'll learn.
YouTube. I noticed her accent. Okay. Yeah. I noticed her accent, like,
oh, yeah.
Just
dope. Mm-hmm. Like, it just diluted immensely. It was insane. And then, like, also, you know, no hate, but actually to appreciate that, you know, she lives, to my understanding, in New York, right? And this idea of just, like, having to export yourself, as Jenica mentioned in our preview conversation, I really like that phrase, in order to make it, is something that has been very constant in my mind in a way that I haven't really seen clearly or been able to acknowledge until recently. Yeah. And it's also, quite frankly, because it's so encouraged, right?
No, that idea that if you don't make it, if you don't make it up north, you haven't really made it.
XYZ.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, for sure. You know, we're going to get to the Q&A in about 5 minutes here. Before we do that, and I know 5 minutes is not nearly long enough to really get into this topic the way we want to, but I'm gonna throw the grenade out there, y'all. Are you ready for the bomb? Here comes the bomb. Two words, Amanda Gorman. All right. Errol, I know you got some feelings about this. I know you got one or two things to say about this. And so I want to hear them. Come on, let's go.
Well, at the time I was taking a break from social media, particularly Instagram and Facebook. I was part of a Facebook group that was majority white, and there was a post about it. And I was like, oh my gosh, they're featuring a Black woman. You know, and then I started reading the comments. I'm like, oh no, wait, what
never
happened?
Never read the comments.
And the more, yeah.
If you want to be actually, happy, never read the comments.
You know, as multilinguals, maybe you can relate to this, reading something in another language to sort of have an emotional detachment from it, if it's in one of your native languages. So I read an article in Japanese and I was like, okay, sounds like someone didn't fit certain criteria and it's no longer working, you know, with the stuff. So I'm just going to try to stay objective as possible. And, you know, I did, I like I said, I started writing from social media, but I would occasionally scroll on LinkedIn because that's where I get some projects coming through. And there was a translator I was following who's white. I think she lives in Italy. And LinkedIn kind of cuts off after a couple of words, but it was like, I need to speak up for translators everywhere. I'm like, Errol, don't click read more. Don't do it. But I did it.
But and you did, you know, it. Again, you did it. You pushed that button.
Again, criticism. And then, oh yeah, doom scroll. Like 100%. I go into the comments. People are saying, even Black people would struggle with, you know, translating. It's like, so let them struggle with it.
Okay, we'll struggle.
Yeah, so I was like, all right, no more LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. I'm part of the American Translators Association, probably not next year. And I think, Wayne, we were at the, I think I met you at one of the one they had last year, their virtual conference.
Yes, I was there. Yep.
All that wonderful newsletter where it says, Amanda Gorman gets criticism for her criteria. I'm like, okay, trying to sit on the fence, but all right, let's see how objective you can stay. And I open an article and this is what gets me. Saying that a Black person, only a Black person can translate Amanda Gorman's literature is equivalent to saying that I can't translate Homer's The Odyssey because I'm not Greek. And I'm like, oh yeah, because I remember Homer was really struggling to find like jobs and dealing with racism. Oh, that's right. He wasn't because he's not Black. And this is the dumbest metaphor, whatever I've ever seen in my life. And what really stands out to me is, I'm going to calm down, inside voice.
But no, it's good. It's good.
All the criticism, all like the comment, they're coming from white people in high positions and PWIs. And it's like, funny. I mean, have you asked what a Black translator thinks about this?
There we go.
Like, I love how, you know, we can't even get our own two cents in. But white people, white translators are saying, of course, Black people should have more jobs, but you shouldn't get it just because you're Black. Race shouldn't be a factor. I'm like, okay, when was it never a factor?
Exactly. You know what that reminds me of? People who say politics should be kept out of the workplace. I'm like, the people who say politics should be kept out of the workplace never needed an act of politics to get in the workplace in the first place. So that's, you know, it's real nice to be able to say, oh, politics should be kept out of the workplace. Well, I'm sorry, until about 1965, I didn't even wasn't able to get my foot in the door. And it took a political act to get me there. So my presence is political by default.
Right.
So
yeah.
If you want politics in the workplace, what you've just told me is you don't want me in the workplace, really. Certainly not in the fullness of myself, right? No, absolutely, absolutely. And yeah, that because I can see different aspects of what people are saying about the Amanda Gorman thing. That having been said, that whole, yeah, the Homeric Greek verse, you know, so that means a person who isn't Greek can't translate Homer. That is such a red herring argument. Because right. even, and I say this as somebody who is Greek by marriage, even modern day Greeks have a tenuous relationship with ancient Greek ideology and ancient Greekness, right? We're not talking about anybody's current lived experience. Right. So, and saying that, trying to throw Homer in there is just trying to ignore the fact that we're talking about, again, lived experience of
and again,
a current
population. Zooming out, right? Zooming out. This is what gets visibility in a newsletter that's going to thousands of people mm-hmm. across the country, mm-hmm. right? Or the world, mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like this is what gets put on a spotlight. This is what's getting highlighted and talked
right.
about. It feels
right.
like. Couldn't spend a couple more minutes, couldn't go through your you know, list of thousands of paying members mm-hmm. and try to sort out, hey, maybe this is the Black person I can reach out to and mm-hmm. get their opinion on something. It just, you know, it's like the more I get into marketing and how all this stuff is coming together, the more intentional a lot of this stuff really seems. The work, mm-hmm. the hard work that goes into a newsletter, at some point, you know that someone who looks like you or doesn't have your best intentions in mind isn't in the room. Because all that shit just got green-lighted. Mm-hmm. And like, mm-hmm. it all got green-lighted. Mm-hmm. It's like, nobody was there to say, yeah, no. Yeah. That's why it's so important that we keep doing this work.
No, absolutely.
It's just ridiculous. So luckily, I got busy with a mortgage translation. That was really funny. Have you ever translated Japanese W-2s? I have not.
Oh, I have not. I've done lots of Japanese patents, but never done a W-2.
Thank God I have not.
Yeah. So that was a lovely distraction, but sometimes I need to do that to just, one, pay the bills, and two, to just like, oof, ground myself, because it can just get really frustrating, mm-hmm. the lack of just consideration. And like yeah. the lack of self-awareness. Like you said, people are saying, oh, let's not get political. But who does that benefit?
Exactly.
They're like, who's benefiting? From?
Exactly, exactly.
That's my two cents.
No, and it's funny what you said about newsletters, because I have seen many from all sorts of different organizations, many a newsletter, many an email, many an article, whatever. And I'm looking, I'm like, you absolutely did not have any of the affected parties in the room when you wrote this, because this is completely represented from the perspective of somebody that does not have any skin in the game. It's loud and clear when you see certain things like that. Absolutely. All right. So in this last half hour, we're going to move in to sort of a Q&A. There are lots of things to talk about here. One question is, and this, because I think it's really good. A conversation like this is really important to sort of have a statement of problem, right? And especially for the language services industry, because this conversation hasn't really been happening much. So a lot of people don't even know what the problem is. And so that's a really important thing to say, okay, here's what the problem is. We've done some of that, you know, what we would call an education scaffolding. We've contextualized the problem. Now, let's move into maybe potential solutions. And no, we're not going to solve it in the next half hour. I know, you know, I don't think anybody has any illusions about that. If we do, we're pretty awesome. We're like Justice League. But no, we're not going to. But let's look at some potential solutions. What are some potential paths forward that make things look better? I think we've established that there is a problem. We've established what some of the problem is and some of the intersections that go into it. You know, Anglophone supremacy, racism, white privilege, classism, a sort of a split between management and the proletariat. Like, there are a lot of things that are going into this, right? So how do we untangle this knot? And one of the questions that came in, and this is an interesting idea, and I want to hear what everybody thinks about it. So give me your best 60 to 120 seconds on this idea. Would it be helpful to start a Black in localization group similar to the Women in Localization group? Autumn, you're on.
Okay, so with this one, it depends on who is creating this and for what purpose. I think there are Black groups that do exist within tech sphere and within like any field. So it does make sense to have this kind of organization. But I think what's important is the who are we serving and why that Jamila brought up earlier, mm-hmm. right?
That was a brilliant point.
it does tie into that from my personal opinion. Because there are some people who would say that, you know, like, are you creating this because you feel bad and you want to try to soothe your consciousness and make it feel like, you know, you're doing something. This is the whole savior complex thing that comes into mm-hmm. play. Or is it Black people creating this as a safe space for Black people within the localization industry? Mm-hmm. In that case, I do think that is something that's strong. It's a community. It's that network that Jamila was talking about. It's talking to the people that look like you about the opportunities mm-hmm. that do exist. So in that case, mm-hmm. agreed mm-hmm. Yep. with under conditions.
Right. No, makes a lot of sense. And somebody said, why not invite Black, whites, and everyone? And I'm just going to say, in all frankness, because whites are already there. We don't need a white people in localization group. That's just called localization. Like, let's be very honest about it. You have these special interest groups because you're focusing on people who have not been traditionally represented or who have had systemic barriers put in place, right? So that's why. It's not saying that white people have nothing to add to the conversation. No, that's not it at all. But it's saying there is a certain interest you may have and a certain lack of representation you may have as a Black person in this space, and you need to figure out a way to start carving out some more space, to start pulling some chairs away from the table, kicking some doors down. Choose your metaphor. So, you know, I think that that's really important to remember. Let's see, Dwayne, your best 60 to 120 seconds. Should we have a Black and localization group?
Well, honestly, I think I'm going to go along the same lines as Autumn and say that it all depends on the context. And I like the idea of what Jamila said about who are we serving. You know, if we are trying to create a group that I think is going to take us all out of our isolation and say that, okay, well, maybe we as a BIPOC community are underrepresented, sure. But again, I think it's just a question of context. I have to say, I am not all familiar with this whole TNI localization thing, and you know, and I'm not familiar with you know the racial makeup of these groups. So I honestly cannot really say much about that. I will say that right now. So I'm just going to repeat myself and just dovetail on what Autumn said. Context. This is something I've learned in translation and interpretation circles. Context is everything. So. I think it's just a question of, you know, why do we need it? Who are we serving? For what purpose? Mm-hmm. And I think once we've answered those questions, then I think we can see if, you know, there's a need to segregate, you know, the BIPOC community from our other compatriots. So mm-hmm. that's my two cents right there.
That makes a lot of sense. And you're right, context is everything. And that, you know, it could be that a Black and localization group would be more necessary, say, for the United States or Canada or something like that. But if you're in Cuba, right, or Dominican Republic, like, we're good. We're good, yo. So that takes me to Jenica. What do you think?
That was precisely my comment. And absolutely not to be insensitive to your needs up north. The Caribbean is a context, and mm-hmm. I have a short anecdote that for me personally, because I've lived physically in several other countries, I have very tight connections with people across the region and interpreters and language professionals, so that now some of us are on a bid right now for a pretty big bid. When we did the bid meeting with the client or potential client, we all knew each other. We were actually chatting in the chat window before the client started talking. We're like, hey, long time haven't seen you. Hey, how things down south? How things in Guadeloupe? How things in Suriname? We know each other. So there is this this group without being a structured group. And we know who our colleagues are in the space. And sometimes we are competitors, but guess what? At the end of the day, if my colleague can't step up to the plate for whatever reason, they're gonna call me a colleague. They're not gonna call me a competitor. So I think the notion of a group is also something you need to look at. But we are a group in the Caribbean. We're a big, happy Caribbean family. So we're doing that already.
So it already exists. It just doesn't exist up here. But ain't that the global north, though? Well, it doesn't exist up here, so does it exist at all? It probably doesn't. If it ain't up here, it ain't around, y'all. All right, Kamisia, what do you think? Black and localization. Good idea, bad idea?
Yeah. I think it's a good idea. I think it's necessary. And I think that Jenica makes a point, but it's a point that does not stand, as we said, right, across all contexts, especially if we go a little further south. So my former claim to fame, I guess we could say that, I'm not famous in any capacity, but I spent a lot of time studying the Afro-Argentine social movement, right, and other Afro-Latin American social movements. And immediately what came to mind is that there has been agitation for a basically a black and localization or a Black Translators Association in Abratis, the Brazilian version of ATA, basically the Brazilian Translation Association. And this is a conversation that kind of like recycles and comes back up. And I'm not sure the current status of that, but I only mention it to say that we do also need to be mindful of global contexts aren't always majority minority either, mm-hmm. right? And even when they are, like Brazil, the powers that be are not necessarily representative of the people in that same to that same proportion, right? 100%. So I'm thinking about how useful it would be to have sort of this type of organization and just the conversations that are already coming out of Brazil and I believe also Colombia. Mm-hmm. But your point is also taken, Jenica, and it does sound more and more like paradise. So,
well, and you know, that is a really good point too, because there are certain points of contact, you know, again, like we said at the head of this, the Black experience in different countries and even within one country looks different. But there are, especially in the diaspora, I do see certain points of contact. For example, you know, I talk to my Black Brazilian friends and they talk about some of the Black Brazilian experience. Now, people who look like me are in the majority in Brazil, but that doesn't mean that we're in the majority in the upper echelons of power. And so we sort of recognize that when we're talking to each other. So they are those, and same with Colombia, my cousin's from Colombia. And, you know, we'll be talking about the dynamics there. And though people that look like us may be, you know, all over, when you get into the boardrooms, how many people are there? And then the number becomes, mm-hmm. you know, vanishingly small. So those are two points that may be in tension, but they're really, really important because they're both equally true context. And finally, Errol, what do you think? Black and localization. Good idea, bad idea? Since you're the last person speaking, it's basically if you say yes or no, that's going to decide if we, as the ambassadors of Blackness, make the group or not.
Okay, no pressure. Like, all right. I think it is a wonderful idea. But can it be a well-implemented strategy? Mm. Anytime someone talks about starting something, you know, be an organization, a club, whatever it is, you know, what kind of framework are you working with? And I did marketing communications for an AMC, it's Association Management Company. They basically, you know, help volunteer-driven organizations. And we lost the proposal, but it was for OBAP, the Organization of Black Aerospace Professionals. I was like, mm-hmm. Black astronauts? Yes. I'm so sad they said no to us, but but there was a, you know, same structure for organization we proposed working with. You know, what's your marketing strategy? What does your leadership look like? How is your, you know, event planning? It's a huge commitment, and you know, passion without action is just like a fantasy. I'm pretty sure I'm not quoting that correctly, but great idea. Work on it and get back to me.
No, and I think I think you're right. And you hit on something that's really, really important in D&I work. And as when I do DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion consulting, I talk about this a lot. Do not mistake motion for action. Don't think that just because you did something that you did the thing that needed to be done, or that you did it in the way that it needed to be done. If this is just a box to check so that you can say, oh yeah, then actually don't waste my time, because the illusion of progress can sometimes be more damaging than the actual lack of progress. The lack of progress, you can see, right? That's right in front of you. You know the enemy you have to fight, the hill you have to climb. Whoa, Amanda Gordon reference. But you, if that actually was completely spontaneous, I'm pretty happy with myself. But if you have an illusion of progress, then all of a sudden you think, oh, okay, things are better. And you kind of get lulled into a sense of complacency, only to have a fairly rude awakening, a few steps down the road. And you're like, oh, I guess they weren't better, but I wasn't prepared for this fight anymore. I thought I'd reached the mountaintop. And turns out I had just reached a flat place before the ascent got really steep. So you make a really good point. Do it, sure, but do it well, and do it for the right reasons. And make sure that the affected parties, this is something that the disability community has really taught me, nothing about us without us. Make sure the affected parties are the ones at the steering wheel. Because if not, it's just a bunch of smoke and mirrors, y'all. Okay. Another question. This is actually really interesting because it gets into its language, but it's also technology, right? Somebody had sent in a question, really, really brilliant one. It says, well known that neural networks can be very biased depending on how they are coded, and especially in the on the training data. Tay, Microsoft's infamous chatbot that learned to spew racist rants in 2016, for example. It's also known that machine translation can be sexist, especially when translating between gendered and non-gendered languages. Shout out to Multilingual. We've been doing a lot of articles on that. Just go to multilingual.com. You'll find plenty of them. Have you encountered a similar bias in terms of race when working with machine translation? More generally, how can linguists avoid sexist and racist bias when working with machine translation and other language modeling neural networks? So I will go to, let's see, actually Autumn, because you I think have your hands in that whole tech thing. I was gonna make a Battlestar Galactica reference with the Cylons.
Why not?
I don't know how many people would get it.
I was expecting it, Michael.
Okay. So you've been working on the Cylons, who will eventually destroy us all. What do you think?
Yes, it's my job. No, it's actually Jane Nankova's job. One of the professors at MIST that I'm very, very lucky to be currently studying with, she basically single-handedly created Lionbridge's AI department. But we're exactly talking about this subject at the moment. Essentially, the main problem, no matter how great your system is, no matter how many parameters you have, aka Google's 1.7 trillion parameter machine learning model that's coming out. The problem is, and I can send you guys the article later, there's a line that says they're using a corpus which draws from Reddit and Wikipedia and other online sources.
Like, I can think of three problems just off the top of my head with that, but okay, yeah, sorry, my bad.
And so, yes, there's 1.7 trillion parameters. Yes, there's 3,000 expert researchers that are working with the data, and they're kind of filing through it. But the problem lies with the source content. We as humans are biased. We all have unconscious bias as well.
Absolutely.
And anything Absolutely. We create is going to be biased. And so while we're getting to the point where we're just pushing for speed at this point, we're just pushing to get the next biggest thing, the ethical and moral concerns regarding this have become a kind of side story. Like, yes, these problems occur. And when they do occur, it's really bad. But they kind of say, oh, yeah, we'll fix that later. But there needs to be it's very easy to train machines to flag certain things and to file those away to be checked by humans, and then over time train it to no longer recognize these phrases, mm-hmm. And recognize this is not okay. Mm-hmm. But it's a journey. It's a long mm-hmm. process. It's difficult. Mm-hmm. And as long as we're humans creating things that go into yeah. AI, it's never, we're human. We're, it's just a reflection of who we are. But mainly there needs yeah. to be a process and put more priority on the ethical concerns around AI if this is ever going to be solved.
I was just going to say the fact that profit is coming, I mean, and it always does in the corporate world, but that's one of the problems with the corporate world is that the profit comes before the moral and the ethical considerations, right? But the fact of the matter is we live as humans in a society, and societies are glued together or even loosely sort of bounded at their edges by social, moral, ethical considerations, right? The whole what we owe to each other question. So if we're putting profit at the beginning of the considerations, and really a consideration for speed is a consideration for efficiency, which is a consideration for profitability, then we've got a problem because we're developing things that can have material impact on people's lives in an unjust way, but we're not putting the ethical, moral considerations at the front of it. And I think that's really distressing. And somebody made a comment I just wanted to say in the chat, which I really, really liked about Brazil. And they said, we have English classes since preschool. It's that illusion that you can only make it in life if you speak English. And I think part of that ties into, you know, what we've been talking about. A lot of people do get fed the idea that economic mobility, that access, that success can really only be had through the medium of English, right? That English is, if not a sufficient, a necessary condition for success. And I think that's real. We need to really examine what are we telling people when we tell them that. What we're really saying is your language isn't good enough. I mean, it's okay, but it's not really good enough. It's not the key. It's not the golden ticket that's going to get you where you want to go. And I think that's a really damaging thing. You know, my in-laws, a lot of them don't speak English. And sometimes they're apologetic about it. I'm like, you don't need to be. You don't live in an English-speaking country. You're not in an English-speaking milieu. You don't need to apologize for not speaking English. You are a brilliant person. Your English ability or lack thereof bears on that, not at all. But so many people, I mean, Autumn, I know you dig this, having lived in Japan, like, English is, oh man, people fall all over themselves for English. And it's like, and people will ask for your TOEIC scores. For those of you who don't know, TOEIC is a standardized English test that's really popular in Japan. Employers will ask for your TOEIC scores, even if you're doing a job that has nothing to do with English. Like, you'll never be speaking English in that job, but people will want to know your TOEIC score, which is, it's just sort of, it's again, the PR of English. What English has sold itself as far outstrips its reality, but it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? If you structure things in a way to advantage people who will be advantaged by such a thing. Does anybody else have anything to say on the bias in machine translation? Because I went to Autumn because I know that that's a little bit more in her wheelhouse, but if somebody else has something to say, I definitely want to hear it. So I'll sort of throw it open here.
So I just want to share, it's a quote, I can't remember who said it, but it was brilliant in that the only way that machines will replace human translators is if the translator is translating like a machine. So mm-hmm. as the human translators, we have to remember what is our added value. And of mm-hmm. course, AI can help get the job done faster, mm-hmm. but I've just finished, and let me make a shameless plug here. I've just finished translating my own book, originally written in English, and I've translated it into French. And I can tell you, I've used AI to get through the bulk of it, but I've had to go over painstakingly and review it myself, my own writing. I'm in the head of the author, translating the author's work, but I'm going through it. And mm-hmm. I think it's a great process.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you, absolutely. And I think one thing we need to look at too, and this really touches on a lot of the things that we've said, when we're looking at a machine translation that is based on a corpus, it's incredibly problematic because what we're doing is we're dealing with people who are used to languages that are either isolating languages like Mandarin or English, or somewhat synthetic languages like the Romance languages, Germanic languages, things like that. We're not talking about people who have deep experience dealing with agglutinative languages like a lot of the Inuit languages, for example, where something that is a whole sentence can be glossed as one word, right? And so you can have a corpus that seems to have thousands of distinct words in it, but really they're all sort of going around the same concept. And so, you know, the corpus data isn't really going to be able to get you the kind of data that you need to be able to do good machine translation. We also did, and I'm trying to plug multilingual, but I'm not intentionally doing it, but we've been doing articles on, for example, how Google Translate really falls down on the job when it comes to a lot of African languages, especially Bantu languages. Most of them have between 9 and 15 noun classes, right? And the kind of machine translation that's been developed for French or Spanish, okay, that's great, but it doesn't work, for example, for a lot of Bantu languages. So, but that was clearly the fact that it doesn't work means that it was an afterthought to a lot of people. Even though, for example, Kiswahili or Isikosa have millions of speakers, nobody really thought about it, right? Nobody thought, we probably should include some training data for these languages as well. But that goes exactly to what you're saying, Autumn, and what you're saying, Jenica. It's because the people who were the ones responsible for getting the training data made the decision that this isn't as important as this is, right? It's not that it's not there. Actually, Swahili has a long literary tradition, but again, nobody really thought of it. So, all right. We are in our last 4 minutes here. I knew we were all going to have way more to say than we had time to say it. Mm-hmm. That's just how it goes. This is me, I was going to say subtly, but I don't do subtle. So this is me openly angling for a part two, because I think it would be really good. I don't know if any of the other people watching would be interested in it. I hope you would. But I think there's a lot more to say here. But in our final, now it is 3 minutes. Just give me a good 45 seconds. If somebody takes away nothing else from this show, what do you want them to walk away with? And I'm going to start with you, Dwayne.
Well, I think what we can take away from this experience is that there is clearly a lot more work that has to be done to recruit people from all walks of life into the T&I industry. If I had more time, I would have said that, you know, for instance, the T&I departments in universities, I think, should extend their hands, I think, to other departments. And I think that's one way that we could improve the mm-hmm. diversity, equity, and inclusion. So I think that's the one thing we could take away from this. There is still work that has to be done, mm-hmm. you know, and this is going to be a long-term process, and it's going to take effort on behalf of other people. And I guess very lastly, I would say, sure, if you want to have any type of localization or any groups dedicated mm-hmm. to certain communities, it's fine. But as I said before, remember the mantra, context is everything.
Nice. Errol.
I just want to say that doing things like this, connecting with people and hearing different experiences and you know, perspective on things, it really makes you re-examine all the experiences you've had in your own life. And it makes you rethink moving forward, how to approach things and how to either be more inclusive or just more cognizant and conscious of what's in the room, what's not in the room, what mm-hmm. could change, what could be better. And even with languages, it's so important to understand that it's not just words on a page. They're not just letters and characters. Mm-hmm. There's so much mm-hmm. more to it. And we should never forget that. So that's my biggest takeaway.
Awesome. Thank you. Autumn.
Yeah. So my biggest takeaway is from our conversation was the lack of opportunity being the biggest barrier to what we all were trying to do. We didn't have the people there to connect us from point A to point B. And it is so easy to become that person for someone. It's so easy to uplift your community and uplift people around you and to just connect them. Mm-hmm. If you see someone that you know that you're like, this person could just connecting them to the person that they want to talk to, connecting them. You don't know how far that takes someone. And I make it my mission to talk to schools, no matter how early in the process, whether it's kindergarten, middle school, high school, talking to schools about the fact that this is a possibility as early as possible, and creating that pathway for them is essential for the future of diversity in our industry.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's why I love this. We are being the people we needed. So Kamisia, it's your 45 seconds.
Oh boy. All right. You emphasize that time because you know I tend to go over.
No shit.
if there's one thing I'd want people to walk away with, is that I really think that we're at an exciting point of a reconsideration of values, because to go off of what Errol was saying about languages and it's not just words on a page, right? It's whole knowledges. And when we talk about corpus, right? So we're talking about the digital corpus or the collection of words that are being considered, right? But it's also the bodies. What am I trying to say? I think that there is a way that we are getting towards integrating the body politic here that is requiring us all to be more intentional. And I think that in that, there's going to be an exercise of defining and then and enunciating and then aligning with our values. And I'm excited for that. So,
thank you. And last but not least, Jenica.
Language bridges barriers and language opens doors.
That was really brilliant, actually. That's gonna be the subtitle for part two. I really like that.
Company interpreting a news.
All right. I really, really appreciate all of you being here today. This has been a fantastic discussion. I've loved hearing your perspectives. These things that you've said have made me think of other things, made me sort of look at things from a slightly different angle than I had considered them before, sort of hit some of my blind spots, which I love conversations that can do that. I really appreciate you taking the time to be here, to be honest, to be authentic, to be vulnerable and share your experiences. And we really appreciate everybody out there who's been watching and listening. Really hope you got something out of this conversation. You might've heard a couple of things that were uncomfortable, but these are the conversations that move things forward. This is how change happens. And it's a change that is long overdue. So thank you everybody for attending. The recording of this webinar will be available later. Thank you everybody in the background for the producing, Evie and Oscar, really appreciate that. This literally would not be happening without you. So massive thanks to you. And yes, muchísimas gracias. And we will talk to you all later.